Success Live with the Reverend Donald Gordon Carkey, Ph.D.
Accept responsibility for where you are today, or you'll be powerless to change. Most people don't take responsibility for their present results. They honestly believe the cause of their current results lies outside of themselves due to the conditions or circumstances they have no control over. The key is to understand that you are responsible for everything in your life. Everything. At some level, consciously or unconsciously, you attracted every person, every job, every idea, every illness, every joy, and every bit of pain into your life. Once you accept that you are the maker of your own reality, you will see that you have the power to change that reality into anything you wish. Think of the possibilities. A new reality. Welcome to the Beyond Belief telecast. My name is Donald Gordon Carkey, and I am your host. Let's take a little journey, you and I, along the banks of the stream. In today's world, most magic is merely entertainment. Digital computer graphics, special effects, and sleight of hand. A carefully orchestrated chorus of illusion. Yet each one of us, no matter how cynical or logical, wants to believe the magic. The magic to change age-old conflicts into lasting peace. The magic to transform scarcity into abundance. The magic to spin our deepest desires and dreams into real-world reality. And most important of all, the magic to dissolve fear and love. Perhaps you've encountered this sort of magic, or maybe you haven't, yet. Aware or not, day in and day out, you experience the world in your own unique way, a one-of-a-kind perspective assembled by what you have agreed to believe. Your beliefs explain how the world is, but only how it is for you, your own personal virtual reality. Your reality is what you assume to be true, based on what you believe. Your beliefs are either summaries of your own experience, or, more likely, digested summaries that you accepted from people you trusted. Your beliefs can support your happiness or your depression. Beliefs are not facts. We are creatures who live in a world of stories, and we're always looking for simple stories to explain the world. There is a story of a group of Harvard grads at graduation describing and trying to explain the seasons. Almost everyone thought the seasons were caused by the elliptical orbit and varying distance of the Earth around the sun. It didn't matter whether or not the students were science majors. Interestingly, people know the seasons are reversed between the northern and southern hemispheres based on the tilt of the Earth's axis. Their stories are inconsistent with what they know, yet they persist in believing them, even though they have the knowledge that contradicts their theory. When we talk, we do nothing but tell stories that people will find interesting. There's danger in that because stories can create resonance without being truth or fact. Early cultures identified celestial objects with gods and spirits, belief in a flat earth found in mankind's oldest writings. In early Mesopotamian thought, the world was portrayed as a flat disk floating in the ocean. Later, most believed the earth, shaped like a section of a pillar or a cylinder, was held aloft at the center of everything. The sun, moon, and planets were holes in invisible wheels surrounding the earth. Through the holes, humans could see concealed fire. 400 years ago, we believed the moon created light itself, and that the blood that courses through our veins ebbed and flowed under the motive power of the liver, just as the tides of the earth ebbed and flowed under the motive power of the moon. 300 years ago, some racers were not only considered but three-fifth human beings, others were completely excluded as being considered human at all. Yet many people believed you had to look at the world with open eyes to comprehend it, and that fundamental lesson had almost been forgotten. Once it was recovered and became widely accepted, the spirit of free inquiry could begin. The discovery of the microscope 300 years ago revealed otherwise invisible and previously unsuspecting worlds, and the telescope hitherto unsuspected phenomena in the heavens, and became the first extension of one of humankind's senses. Probably you accepted most of your beliefs about the world from your early authorities, your parents, relatives, and teachers. Hence, many of your perceptions about reality may be based on obsolete concepts and are in urgent need of revision. Every medical student learns, at least in passing, that the mind can affect the body. They learn that some people get better when they believe they are getting medicine. When patients get better by ingesting a sugar pill, medicine defines it as the placebo effect. I call it that which is beyond belief, to stress that our perceptions, whether they are accurate or inaccurately, equally impact our behavior and our bodies and our environment. I celebrate that which is beyond belief, which is an amazing testament to the healing ability of the body-mind. However, the all-in-their-minds placebo effect has been linked by traditional medicine to, at worst, quacks or, at best, weak, suggestible patients. The placebo effect is quickly glossed over in the medical school so that students can get to the real tools of modern medicine, like drugs and surgery. I believe that we should not dismiss the power of the mind as something inferior to the power of chemicals and the scalpel. I believe the reasons the mind has so summarily been dismissed in medicine is the result of not looking beyond the current model of thinking. In fact, pharmaceutical manufacturers have found that in most of their clinical trials, the placebos, the fake drugs, prove to be as effective as their engineered chemical cocktails. Some historians make a strong case that the history of medicine is largely the history of the placebo effect. For most of medical history, doctors did not have effective methods to fight disease. Some of the more notorious treatments once prescribed by mainstream medicine included bloodletting, treating wounds with arsenic, and the proverbial cure-all, rattlesnake oil. No doubt some patients, the conservatively estimated one-third of the population who are particularly susceptible to the healing power of the placebo effect, got better with those treatments. In today's world, when doctors wearing white coats deliver a treatment decisively, patients may believe the treatment works, and so it does, whether it is a real drug or just a sugar pill. Though the question of how placebos work has some mainstream medical researchers turning their attention to it, the results of those studies suggest that it's not only wacky 19th century treatments that can foster a placebo effect, but also modern medicine's sophisticated technology, including the most concrete of medical tools, surgery. A Baylor School of Medicine study published in 2002 in the New England Journal of Medicine evaluated surgery for patients with severe debilitating knee pain. The lead author of the study, Dr. Bruce Mosley, knew that knee surgery helped his patients. All good surgeons know there is no placebo effect in surgery, but Mosley was trying to figure out which part of the surgery was giving his patients relief. The patients in the studies were divided into three groups. Mosley shaved the damaged cartilage in the knee of one group. For another group, he flushed out the knee joint, removing material thought to be causing the inflammatory effect. Both of these constitute standard treatment for arthritic knees. The third group got fake surgery. The patient was sedated. Mosley had three standard incisions and then talked and acted just as he would have during a real surgery. He even splashed salt water to simulate the sound of the knee washing procedure. After 40 minutes, Mosley sewed up the incisions as if he had done the surgery. All three groups were prescribed the same post-operative care, which included an exercise program. The results were shocking. Yes, the groups who received surgery, as expected, improved. But the placebo group improved just as much as the other two groups. The results were clear to Mosley. My skill as a surgeon had no benefit on these patients. The entire benefit of surgery for osteoarthritis of the knee was the placebo effect. Television news programs graphically illustrated the stunning results. Footage showed members of the placebo group walking and playing basketball. In short, doing things they reported they could not do before the surgery. The placebo patients didn't find out for 2 years that they had gotten fake surgery. One member of the placebo group, Tim Perez, who had to walk with a cane before the surgery, is now able to play basketball with his grandchildren. He summed up the theme of this lecture when he told the Discovery Health Channel, "In this world, anything is possible when you put your mind to it. I know that your mind can work miracles." Studies have shown the placebo effect to be powerful in treating other diseases, including asthma and Parkinson's. In the treatment of depression, placebos are stars, so much so that psychiatrist Walter Brown of the Brown University School of Medicine has proposed placebo pills as the first treatment for patients with mild or moderate depression. Patients would be told that they're getting a remedy with no active ingredient, but that shouldn't dampen the pill's effectiveness. Studies suggest that even when people know they're not getting a drug, the placebo pills still work. One indication of the power of the placebo came from a report from the United States Department of Health and Human Services. The report found that half of severely depressed patients taking drugs improved versus 32% taking a placebo. Even that impressive showing may underestimate the power of the placebo effect because many study participants figure out they're taking the real drug because they experience side effects that are not experienced by those taking the placebo. Once these patients realize they're taking the drug, once they start believing that they're getting the real pill, they are particularly more susceptible to the placebo effect. Given the power of the placebo, it is no wonder that the pharmaceutical industry is under attack by critics who charge that drug companies are hyping the effectiveness of their pills. In a 2002 article in the American Psychological Association's Prevention and Treatment, The Emperor's New Drugs, University of Connecticut psychology professor Irvin Kirsch found that 80% of the effect of antidepressants as measured in clinical trials could be attributed to the placebo effect. Kirsch had to invoke the Freedom of Information Act in 2001 to get information on the clinical trials of the top antidepressants. These data were not forthcoming from the Food and Drug Administration. The data show that in more than half of the clinical trials for the six leading antidepressants, the drugs did not outperform placebo, sugar pills. And Kirsch noted in a Discovery Health Channel interview that the difference between the response of the drugs and the response of placebo was less than 2 points on average on this clinical scale that goes from 50 to 60 points. That's a very small difference. That difference clinically is meaningless. Another interesting fact about the effectiveness of antidepressants is that they have performed better and better in clinical trials over the years, suggesting that the placebo effects are in part due to savvy marketing. The more the miracle antidepressant was touted in the media and in advertisements, the more effective they became. Beliefs are contagious. We now live in a culture where people believe that antidepressants work, and so they do. While many in the medical profession are aware of the placebo effect, few have considered its implications for self-healing. If positive thinking can pull you out of a depression and heal a damaged knee, consider what negative thinking can do in your life. When the mind, through positive suggestion, improves health, it is referred to as the placebo effect. Conversely, when the same mind is engaged in negative suggestions that can damage health, the negative effects are referred to as the nocebo effect. In medicine, the nocebo effect can be as powerful as the placebo effect, a fact you should keep in mind every time you step into a doctor's office. By their words and their demeanor, physicians and everyone the patient comes in contact with can convey hope-deflating messages. Albert Mason, for example, thinks his inability to project optimism to his patients hampered his efforts with his ichthyosis patients. Another example is the potential power of the statement, "You have 6 months to live." If you choose to believe your doctor's message, you are not likely to have much more time on this earth. I have cited the Discovery Health Channel's 2003 program, Placebo, Mind Over Medicine, in this lecture because it is a good compendium of some of medicine's most interesting cases. One of its more poignant segments featured a Nashville physician, Clifton Medar, who has been reflecting on the potential power of the nocebo effect for 30 years. In 1974, Medar had a patient, Sam Lund, a retired shoe salesman suffering from cancer of the esophagus, a condition that was at the time considered 100% fatal. Lund was treated for that cancer, but everyone in the medical community knew that his esophageal cancer would reoccur. So it was no surprise when Lund died a few weeks after his diagnosis. The surprise came after Lund's death when an autopsy found very little cancer in his body, certainly not enough to kill him. There were a couple of spots in the liver and one in the lung, but there was no trace of the esophageal cancer that everyone thought had killed him. Medar told the Discovery Health Channel, "He died with cancer, but not from cancer." What did Lund die of, if not esophageal cancer? Had he died because he believed he was going to die? The case still haunts Medar 3 decades after Lund's death. I thought he had cancer. He thought he had cancer. Everyone around him thought he had cancer. Did I remove hope in some way? Troublesome nocebo cases suggest that physicians, parents, and teachers can remove hope by programming you to believe you are powerless. Our positive and negative beliefs not only impact our health, but also every aspect of our life. Henry Ford was right about the efficiency of assembly lines, and he was right about the power of the mind. If you believe you can, or if you believe you can't, you're right. Think about the implications of the man who blithely drank the bacteria that medicine had decided caused cholera. Consider the people who walk across coals without getting burned. If they wobble in the steadfastness of their belief that they can do it, they wind up with burned feet. Your beliefs act like filters on a camera, changing how you see the world. In my live lectures, I provide two sets of plastic filters, one red and one green. I have the audience pick one color and then look at a blank screen. I then tell them to yell out whether the image I project next is one that generates love or generates fear. Those of the audience that don the red belief filters see an inviting picture of a cottage labeled House of Love, flowers, a sunny sky, and the message, I live in love. Those wearing the green filters see a threatening dark sky, bats, snakes, a ghost hovering outside, a dark, gloomy house, and the words, I live in fear. I always get enjoyment out of seeing how the audience responds to the confusion when half yell out, I live in love, and the other half, in equal certainty, yells out, I live in fear, in response to the same image. Then I ask the audience to change to the opposite colored filters. My point is that you choose what to see. You can filter your life with rose-colored beliefs that will help your body grow, or you can use dark filter that turns everything black and makes your body-mind more susceptible to disease. You can live a life of fear or live a life of love. You have the choice. But I can tell you that if you choose to see a world full of love, your body will respond by growing in health. If you choose to believe that you live in a dark world full of fear, your body's health will be compromised as you physiologically close yourself down in a protected response. And your physiology adapts to those beliefs. When we truly recognize that our beliefs are that powerful, we hold the key to freedom. While we cannot readily change the codes of our genetic blueprints, we can change our minds. Do a little research for a minute. Stand up or sit up straight. Now allow your head to fall forward, your shoulders to round, your head to tilt to one side, and say to yourself, boy, do I feel happy. What is your internal response? Why doesn't the message work? Okay, change the position and shake off the feelings of the last exercise. Now stand tall, look up, raise your arms, breathe deeply, and say, boy, am I depressed. Once you have stopped laughing at the internal feelings, think for a moment about why neither of these two exercises work from a body-mind point of view. I propose that your physiology was so blatantly and obviously out of sync with the words that the self-imposed inharmonious feeling was absurd. The words you use are the instruments, channels, through which the creative energy takes form. Naturally, this sensitive creative power can only produce in accordance with the instrument through which it passes. All disappointments and failures are the results of endeavoring to think one thing and produce another. Excuse me. This is just as impossible as it would be for an electric fan to be used for lighting purposes or for water to flow through a crooked pipe in a straight line. The water must take the shape of the pipe through which it flows. We think we know how the world works and how things are. It is a function of our ego. But we all get caught up in how we believe things work and how we believe things are. And when we are stuck in this contest, we believe we will triumph, come hell or high water, because we believe it is the right way. But is it? There is a simple practical procedure which will turn us around and set our faces in the right direction. It is a formula on which, consciously or unconsciously, every successful person acts. The procedure is simple. The first steps of putting it into practice so easy that those who prefer to dramatize their difficulties may refuse to believe that anything so uncomplicated could possibly help them. On the other hand, since it takes little time and soon brings its own evidence that, simple or not, its consequences are frequently amazing. It should be worth trying. A richer life, better work, the experiences of success, and its rewards, those ends are surely worth one experiment and procedure. All the equipment needed is imagination and the willingness to disturb old habit patterns and beliefs for a while, to act after a novel fashion long enough to finish one piece of work. How long that period is will vary, of course, with the work to be accomplished and whether it is all dependent on oneself or where the factor of other human temperament must be taken into account. In any case, some results from the experiment will be seen at once. Often these results are so astonishing that to enumerate them now might alienate listeners of a sober habit of mind. To hear of them before coming to them normally would be like hearing of miracles, and some of the effectiveness of the formula might be lost by the intrusion of the very doubts we are to banish. All you need do is act as if it were impossible to fail, and focus on what you seek and why you seek it. The universe will figure out the who, when, where, and how. It is in the details beyond the what and the why that creates doubt and disbelief. What we select to believe forms an intricate aperture through which we perceive everything, a lens projecting a kaleidoscope of dreams, memories, and thoughts, all wrapped up in an emotional point of view. What we experience in every moment is an interpretation, a mind-altering simulation created by the amazing power of what we have chosen to believe. Without exception, we each take the untamed potential of belief and create a unique worldview that drives everything we do. From the raw energy of belief, we fashion a personal dream of life that touches every word we say, every thought we think, every one we meet, and every move we make. Our belief manufactures the prism through which we see life and magically transforms what is into what we believe it is. Suppose that a dozen people are standing on the dark side of a wall in which there are various size openings. Viewing the scene outside through the opening assigned to him or her, one sees all there is within a certain radius. She says, "I see the whole world. In it are trees and fields." Another, through a larger opening, has a more extended view. He says, "I see trees and fields and houses. I see the whole world." The next one, looking through a still larger opening, exclaims, "Oh, you are all wrong. I alone see the whole world. I see trees and fields and houses and rivers and animals." The fact is, each one looking at the same world sees according to the size of the aperture through which they are looking, and they limit the world to just their own circumscribed view of it. I want you to see, if you do not already, that every time you limit your belief in any person or through any person in order to make that belief conform to what you see as truth, you are only crying loudly, "Hey, yo, everyone, come and view my narrowness and my ignorance." Most of our beliefs, like most of our wishes, are unconscious, in the sense that we have never told ourselves that we have them. Such beliefs display themselves when the expectations that they arouse fail in any way. For example, if someone puts tea without milk into a glass and you drink it under the impression that it is going to be beer, or if you walk on what appears to be a tiled floor and it turns out to be a soft carpet made to look like tiles, the shock of surprise on an occasion of this kind makes us aware of the expectations that habitually enter into our perceptions, and such expectations must be classed as beliefs, in spite of the fact that we do not normally take note of them or put them into words. I remember once watching a pigeon running over and over again to the edge of a mirror-like glass window to try to wreak vengeance on the particularly obnoxious bird whom he expected to find there. Judging by what he saw in the glass, he must have experienced each time the sort of surprise on finding nothing, which is calculated to lead in time to the adoption of Berkeley's theory that objects of sense are only in the mind. His expectation, though not expressed in words, deserved, I think, to be called a belief. Changing a belief is letting it go, releasing it. Freeing yourself from a belief, however, is far more than just an intellectual decision. Liberating yourself from belief is often not as simple as deciding to disagree. Disengaging from a belief is more than a conclusion that you can come to. It's an event with life-changing implications. Letting go of a belief is an act of will requiring that you take a precious jewel of immeasurable value and drop it into the deepest part of the ocean where it can never be found again. Remember, the intellect retrieves the information from your library of knowledge, applies it to the situation at hand, and the interpreter within you expresses what you have come to believe. You don't believe what you think. You think what you believe. Behavior is the belief expressing itself and cannot be changed simply by changing your mind. What drives your behavior is not what you think, but what you actually believe. Really letting go of something is a lot like true forgiveness. Consider the act of forgiveness. Are there people whom you have not forgiven? Are there things you have not done that you have not forgiven yourself for? Why not? Often we just can't forgive. Although we may want to completely let it go, the debate in our minds and the emotion tied to the event are too strong, especially when the offense has occurred repeatedly over a long period of time. Our insistence on not forgiving and the arguments that support the position become a jewel of immeasurable value. The attachment is very powerful, much like the tale of Gollum from the book trilogy, The Lord of the Rings, and his addiction to his precious, the One Ring. Listen to the discussion in your mind when you don't forgive, when you can't let it go. It's all about what you did and what they did, what you should have done this or who should have done that, who's right and who's wrong. It sounds like an argument. It sounds like a lawyer arguing a case. When lawyers come together before a judge to plead a case, they provide evidence, cite precedent, and present an argument with one specific goal in mind. They are there to prove they are right. If you listen to what you say to yourself when you think about someone you can't forgive, what you hear is an argument about being right. You can't forgive because you need to be right. The reason we can't let go of what we have come to believe, even if it is no longer serving us, even if we now disagree, is because we are the champion of that point of view and will defend it at every turn to the bitter end if necessary. We need to be right. We cannot see any other way. The other day I was distracted by the sound of buzzing in the window. I turned to my chair and I watched this fly, a common house fly. The fly was banging against this plate glass window in a futile attempt to escape. This fly could see what was on the other side of the window, but try as he might, it was obvious that he would never succeed in breaking through the glass and getting to the other side. Never. It occurred to me that this fly would fight to his death at this losing proposition, a contest that could never be won. Because the glass is impenetrable. No matter what he does, no matter how many times he tries, no matter how many times he bangs his head, and even though he can see where he wants to go, the glass will keep him right where he is. But as I watched this fly, I thought to myself, if he would just turn around and go the other way, he would be able to escape and save his own life. This fly would be able to achieve the goal of freedom that he seeks if he would just turn around and look at the situation from a different perspective. But of course, a fly never does that. A fly will bang against that window for hours on end and even till its death because it cannot see any other way. And so often we do almost the same thing. In order to let go of an agreement with a belief you have that has been reinforced thousands of times, that has your attention, hooks your mind with this point of view, and has an emotional perspective that is both powerful and overwhelming, give up the need to be right. Giving up the need to be right stops every avenue where belief is expressing itself. It suspends justification and evidence-taking, blocking the primary source of nourishment, universal energy working through you. Were it not at times so utterly ridiculous, it would always be pitiful to see the human mind of man trying to limit universal energy to personal comprehension. However much any one of us know of the universe, there will always be unexplored fields in the realms of expression. And it is evidence of our narrow vision to say, this is all there is of the universe. Deciding to give up the need to be right is not just a thought, but a far-reaching action that releases your investment of faith. Faith in what you have come to believe. There are common consequences to clinging to obsolete beliefs, and they include age regression, where you demand that the world follow your childish expectations, emotional stress, you experience overwhelming anger, sadness, or fear, relationship chaos, you use toxic relationship and communication skills, and of course, depression. You attempt to retreat from a life that does not make sense. But there is a place beyond belief. There is an old story which furnishes so good an illustration on this point that I will give it here. It is said that in the Middle Ages, the bones of a saint kept in one of the monasteries were working miracles of healing. On certain days, a great crowd of the afflicted gathered, touched the relics, and all who did were healed. On the eve of one of these occasions, some sacrilegious rascal gained access to the case in which the wonder-working relics were kept and stole the bones. And in the morning, with the usual crowd of sufferers waiting at the gates, the fathers found themselves without the source of the miracle-working power. They resolved to keep the matter quiet, hoping that by doing so they might find the thief and recover their treasures, and hastened to the cellar of the convent. They dug up the bones of a murderer who had been buried there many years before. These they placed in the case, intending to make some plausible excuse for the failure of the saint to perform his usual miracles on the day. And then they led in the waiting assemblage of the sick and infirm. To the intense astonishment of those in on the secret, the bones of the murderer proved as effective as those of the saint, and the healing went on as before. One of the fathers is said to have left a history of the occurrence, in which he confessed that, in his judgment, the healing power had been in the people themselves all the time, and never in the bones at all. Whether the story is true or not, the conclusion applies to all the cures wrought by all the systems. The power that heals is within the patient himself, and whether it shall become active or not does not depend upon the physical or mental means used, but upon the way the person thinks about these means. Hence, a new force has to be taken into account. This is dormant or active according to the way a person thinks. He can always quicken it into activity by thinking beyond belief. Your faith depends upon your beginning to think and act beyond belief. The way a person thinks about things is determined by what he believes about them. His thoughts are determined by his faith, and the results depend upon his making a personal application of his faith. If a person has faith in the efficacy of a medicine and is able to apply that faith to himself, that medicine will certainly cause him to be cured. But though his faith be great, he will not be cured unless he applies it to himself. Many sick people have faith for others, but none for themselves. So if he has faith in a system of diet and can personally apply that faith, it will cure him. And if he has faith in prayers and affirmations and personally applies his faith, prayers and affirmations will cure him. Faith, personally applied, cures. And no matter how great the faith or how persistent the thought, it will not cure without personal application. Beyond belief, then, includes the two fields of thought and action. It is not enough that a person should merely think beyond belief. He must apply his thought to himself, and he must express and externalize it in his outward life by acting in the same way that he thinks. The purpose of nature, so far as a human being is concerned, is that he should be continuously advancing into more life and progressing toward perfect life, and that he should live the most complete life possible in his present sphere of action. This must be so, because that which lives in a person is seeking more life. Give a child a pencil and paper, and he begins to draw crude figures. That which lives in him is trying to express itself in art. Give him a set of blocks, and he will try to build something. That which lives in him is seeking expression in architecture. Seat her at a piano, and she will try to draw harmony from the keys. That which lives in her is trying to express itself in music. Any thought continuously held by a person tends to the establishment of the corresponding condition in his life. The people who were healed by touching the bones of the saint were really healed by thinking beyond belief, and not by any power emanating from relics. There is no healing power in the bones of dead men, whether they be those of saint or sinner. The people who were healed by doses of ether, either the placebo or the chemical or the scalpel, were also really healed by thinking beyond belief. The people who have been healed by prayers and affirmations were also healed by thinking beyond belief. There is no innate power in strings of words. The two essentials of beyond belief are faith and a personal application of the faith. The people who touched the saint's bones had faith, and so great was their faith that in the instant they touched the relics, they severed all mental relations with disease and mentally unified themselves with health. This change of mind was accompanied by intense devotional feeling, which penetrated to the deepest recesses of their souls and so aroused universal energy to powerful action. By faith, they claimed that they were healed, or appropriated health to themselves, and in full faith, they ceased to think of themselves in connection with disease and thought of themselves only in connection with health. We have two main points to consider. First, how to think with faith, and second, how to so apply the thought to ourselves as to quicken universal energy into constructive activity. We begin by learning what to think. Drop all investigation as to your present situation, its causes, or possible results, and set yourself to the work of forming a conception of your new reality. Suspend your current belief. The principle, your new reality, is moved by faith. Nothing else can call it into action, and only faith can enable you to relate yourself to your new reality and sever your relation with the old reality in your thoughts. You'll continue to think of your old reality unless you have faith in your new reality. If you do not have faith, you will doubt. If you doubt, you will fear. And if you fear, you will relate yourself in mind to that which you fear. Let me enlarge somewhat on that point. The potency or creative power of a thought is given to it by the faith that is in it. Thoughts which contain no faith create no forms. Keep in mind the fact that only those thoughts which are conceived in faith have creative energy. Only those thoughts which have faith with them are able to change function or to quicken the principle of your new reality into activity. Faith begins in belief, and we now come to the question, what must you believe in order to have faith in the new reality? You must believe that there is more new reality power than old reality power in both yourself and your environment. And you cannot help believing this if you consider the facts. These are the facts. Universal energy is in your being, moving you toward its new reality. And it is pressing upon you from every side. You live, move, and have your being in a limitless ocean of new reality power. And you use this power according to your faith. If you appropriate it and apply it to yourself, it is all yours. And if you unify yourself with it by unquestioning faith, you cannot fail to attain your new reality. For the power of this energy is all the power there is. A belief in the beloved statement is a foundation for faith in your new reality. If you believe them, you believe that your new reality is the natural state of humanity, and that a human being lives in the midst of universal energy, that all the power of nature makes for the new reality, and that new reality is possible to all and can surely be attained by all. It is not merely the possession of faith, but the personal application of faith which works the new reality. You must claim this new reality in the beginning and form a conception of your new reality, and as far as may be, of yourself as this new reality, and then by faith you must claim that you are realizing this conception. Do not assert with faith that you are going to get your new reality. Assert with faith that you are the new reality. Having faith in this new reality and applying it to yourself means having faith that you are your new reality. And the first step in this is to claim that it is the truth. Mentally take the attitude of your new reality and do not say anything or do anything that contradicts this attitude. Never speak a word or assume a physical attitude that does not harmonize with the claim, I am a new reality. One great aid, perhaps the greatest aid, in applying your faith, you will find in the exercise of gratitude. Whenever you think of yourself or of your advancing condition, give thanks to the universe for the new reality you are enjoying. Whenever the thought of the old reality is presented to you, instantly claim your new reality and thank God for the new reality you have. Do this so that there shall be no room in your mind for a thought of the old reality. Every thought connected in any way with the old reality is unwelcome, and you can close the door of your mind in its face by asserting that you are the new reality and by reverently thanking God that it is so. Soon the old thoughts will return no more. Gratitude has a twofold effect. It strengthens your own faith, and it brings you into close and harmonious relations with the universe. You believe that there is one universal energy from which all life and all power come. You believe that you receive your own life from this substance, and you relate yourself closely to it by feeling continuous gratitude. It is easy to see that the more closely you relate yourself to the universal energy, the more readily you may receive life from it. And it is easy also to see that your relation to it is a matter of mental attitude. We cannot come into physical relationship with God, for God is mind, and we are also mind. Our relation with God must therefore be a mind relation. It is plain, then, that the person who feels deep and hearty gratitude will live in closer touch with God than the person who never looks up to God in thankfulness. The ungrateful or unthankful mind really denies that it receives it all, and so cuts its connection with the universe. The grateful mind is always looking toward the universe and is always open to receive from it, and it will receive continually. A person may cultivate both faith and gratitude by the proper use of the will. You direct the will upon the mind and use it in determining what you shall believe, what you shall think, and what you shall give your attention. The will should never be used upon any person or thing external to you, and it should never be used upon your own body. The sole legitimate use of the will is in determining to what you shall give your attention and what you shall think about the things to which your attention is given. All belief begins in the will to believe. You cannot always and instantly believe that you will to believe, but you can always will to believe what you want to believe. You want to believe truth about your new reality, and you can will to do so. The statements you have heard are the truth about the new reality, and you can will to believe them. This must be your first step toward getting your new reality. These are the statements you must will to believe. You may not be able to form a clear mental image of yourself in your new reality, but you can form a conception of yourself as acting like you are in the new reality. Form this conception and then think only thoughts of the new reality in relation to yourself, and, so far as may be possible, in relation to others. When a thought of the old reality is presented to you, reject it. Do not let it get into your mind. Do not entertain or consider it at all. Meet it by thinking of your new reality, by thinking that you are the new reality, and by being sincerely grateful for the new reality you are receiving. Whenever suggestions of the old reality are coming thick and fast upon you, and you are in a tight place, fall back upon the exercise of gratitude. Connect yourself with the universe. Give thanks to God for the new reality God gives you, and you will soon find yourself able to control your thoughts and to think what you want to think. In times of doubt, trial, and temptation, the exercise of gratitude is always an anchor which will prevent you from being swept away. Remember that the great essential thing is to sever all mental relations with the old reality and to enter into full mental relationship with the new reality. This is the key. Let go of the old limiting beliefs. It is the whole thing. While there is no innate power in the repetition of strings of words, yet it is a very convenient thing to have the central thoughts so formulated that you can repeat them readily, and so that you can use them as affirmations whenever you are surrounded by an environment which gives you adverse suggestions. When those around you begin to talk of the old reality, close your ears and mentally assert something like the following. Exercise your willpower in choosing only those thoughts which are thoughts of your new reality, and arrange your environment so that it shall suggest thoughts of your new reality. Do not have about you books, pictures, or other things that suggest lack, limit, death, disease, fear, or age. Have only those that convey the ideas of health, love, power, joy, vitality, abundance, and youth. When you are confronted with a book or anything else that suggests the old reality, do not give it your attention. Think of your conception of your new reality and your gratitude and affirm as above. Use your willpower to fix your attention upon the thoughts of the new reality. You don't have to use your willpower to conquer adverse conditions or to subdue unfriendly forces. There are no unfriendly forces. There is only one force, and that force is friendly to you. It is a force which makes for your new reality. Everything in the universe wants you to be the new reality. You have absolutely nothing to overcome but your own habit of thinking beyond belief about the old reality. And you can do this only by forming a habit of thinking beyond belief about your new reality. You can think beyond belief by controlling your attention, and you can control your attention by the use of your will. You can decide what things you will think about. William James has pointed out that there is apparently no limit to the powers of the human being, that this is simply because the human being's power comes from the inexhaustible reservoir of the universe. The runner who has reached the stage of exhaustion, when his physical power seems entirely gone, by running on in beyond belief, he may receive his second wind. His strength is renewed in a seemingly miraculous fashion, and he can go on indefinitely. And by continuing in beyond belief, he may receive a third, fourth, fifth wind. We do not know where the limit is, or how far it may be possible to extend it. The conditions are that the runner must have absolute faith that the strength will come, and he must think steadily of strength and have perfect confidence that he has it, and that he must continue to run on. If he admits a doubt into his mind, he falls exhausted, and if he stops running to wait for the accession of strength, it will never come. His faith in strength, his faith that he can keep on running, his unwavering purpose to keep on running, and his action in keeping on seem to connect him to the source of energy in such a way as to bring him a new supply. The mental actions necessary for your new reality may now be summed up in a single sentence. Form a conception of yourself in the new reality, and think only those thoughts which are in harmony with that conception. That, with faith and gratitude and the purpose to really live, covers all the requirements. Learning how to harness your mind to promote growth is the secret of life, which is why I called this lecture Beyond Belief. Of course, the secret of life is not a secret at all. Teachers like Buddha and Jesus have been telling us the same old story for millennia. Now scientists pointing in the same direction. It is not our genes, but our beliefs that control our lives. O ye of little faith, try to do your part in bringing about the results you want. Once more, I caution you not to misuse your newfound power. Do not drag the gift of the Spirit through the mud. Use it freely in your own behalf, in every legitimate way, but harm no man or woman by reason of or by means of. If you fail to grasp the meaning of any of the teachings contained in this lecture, do not feel discouraged, for it will come to you later. Listen again to the areas of this lecture which seem to be most difficult to you, and then place yourself in the relaxed condition of body and mind. Enter the silence, and a new light will break upon you. And now, friends, we have come to the parting of the ways. We may meet again, but if not, let us part feeling that we are none the worse for the short acquaintance. If I have done you any good, if I have awakened in you new thoughts, hopes, and aspirations, may you make them manifest in actions and results. Our little journey along the banks of the stream has been pleasant for me, and I trust that I have not bored you nor caused you to regret the acquaintance. Not a chance acquaintance, you may rest assured, for nothing, absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. I thank you for your kind attention. My name is Donald Gordon Carty, and you're more than welcome to visit my website at www.thepdi.com. Again, I thank you for your kind attention. Now let us go into the silence and go on in full faith.